history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price has been paid for our freedom. And through that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The final year of World War II was so eventful. There have been lots of significant 75th anniversaries, but perhaps the one most worthy of celebrating is the one marked this week, 75 years since the most deadly global conflict in history officially came to an end with the signing of the Instruments of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. That was on September 2, 1945. That historic ship, of course, is now anchored in Pearl Harbor, not far at all from the USS Arizona Memorial, the most visible reminder of the tragic day that drew the United States into World War II. Without that U.S. involvement, the tyrannical forces seeking to dominate the globe would not have been deterred, and 75 years ago this week, people everywhere were relieved that the war that had lasted 4 years for Americans, even longer for those in other parts of the world, was over. The official 75th anniversary commemoration of that long-awaited moment will take place on the Missouri. Organizers had been working hard to arrange to fly dozens of World War II veterans free of charge to Hawaii for the event. As recently as last week, that plan was still moving forward. But as COVID-19 cases have risen on the islands, the difficult decision was made to cancel all travel but still hold a series of events for the anniversary, limiting in-person attendance to veterans who call Hawaii their home. Later on, we'll hear from the executive director of the committee charged with making that special event a reality, and he'll tell us how we can follow along in a live stream on September 2nd. But there are some pretty compelling things for us to listen to before we get to that. We're going to hear what Americans heard on the radio 75 years ago. And with the lens of three quarters of a century of history, I think you'll find it interesting to hear how President Harry Truman, General Douglas MacArthur, and Admiral Chester Nimitz viewed the years that preceded that historic day, as well as what they envisioned for the future and what they thought mattered most. Perhaps you'll even find it relevant to things America and the world are facing today. Because hindsight is 2020, even here in 2020, we know that the surrender ceremony in Tokyo Bay came off largely without a hitch. But there was no guarantee that would be the case, and Allied forces were on alert in case anything would happen. One sailor who helped us understand that dynamic on this program was Mike Wanty, who had by that time survived quite a few close calls on the destroyer USS Lardner.
I think for about 3 months we went back and forth out to sea from Tokyo, and the planes bombarded Tokyo and all around there. And then the war was ended. We were given the honor to be the first ones in Tokyo Harbor.
Your ship?
Yeah, which I didn't think was the best honor. Our captain was smart enough. We went to general quarters, and we had those guns pointed, loaded. There was two Japanese destroyers on either side of us, and he was nervous. We didn't know what they were going to do. They had done kamikaze.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they try and blow up that ship? So we never stopped for about 2 days. We went around and around in the harbor because we were afraid of these one-man submarines, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Was that before they signed the surrender in
yes.
Tokyo Bay?
Yeah.
So you guys went in to kind of make sure that was safe.
That's right, exactly.
So you were expendable.
Yes.
You were the ones that didn't care if you got
we
blown
always
up.
Always were.
You're a destroyer.
Right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Always were. We were lucky we never got hit. The lucky Lardner.
So you guys get word that Japan is going to surrender?
Yeah, we were at sea, and everybody cheered.
But they tell you, you're the first ones in.
We had to go pick up a few of the battle wagons, but we were the lead ship.
Uh-huh.
And we went on in. The battle wagons in the Missouri followed quite a few days after. We were at anchor then, and they anchored very close to us. So I could, with my binoculars, watch everything that was going on.
So you guys circle the harbor. You've got your guns out and all that. You make sure everything's fine. And then you drop anchor and wait for the bigger ships and the dignitaries.
Right.
And so you said you could watch through your binoculars. So were you looking that way when all the bigwigs got on there?
Oh, sure. And then after it was signed, then we had to go pick up prisoners of war. We went north and picked up some prisoners of war, brought them back. By that time, hospital ship was anchored in Tokyo Bay, and we would deliver them.
That was the late Mike Wanty from the destroyer USS Lardner, the first American ship in Tokyo Bay before history was made there 75 years ago. If you happened to visit Julesburg, Colorado this week, you would find a former mayor of that city who has done a phenomenal job of preserving history through his old Ford garage and museum, not to mention the World War II uniforms and memorabilia he displays next door at what used to be the Opera House there. Lee Kaiser just celebrated his 95th birthday, and the instructions Lee and his fellow sailors aboard the destroyer USS Wilson carried 75 years ago in Tokyo Bay underscore that unease you heard Mike Wanty describe.
At the end of the war, when the USS Missouri went into the surrender, we were in the area patrolling. Our order was to, during the ceremony for the surrender, that in case any Vogue Japanese pilot, they didn't want to surrender, shoot them down immediately, but shoot anybody else down. Any other plane in the area, hit them so that they wouldn't fly into the Missouri. And that was our job.
Fortunately, they didn't have to shoot down any enemy planes on September 2nd, 1945. Lee Kaiser would spend the next month on the island of Chichijima, tracking down the remains of downed American pilots whose livers had been eaten by their Japanese captors. Those captors later executed for war crimes as a result of some of the evidence Lee Kaiser and his crew compiled. The crowd on the battleship Missouri on September 2nd, 1945, included some newly liberated prisoners of war like Bill Sanchez, who just turned 102 and will follow the anniversary from his home in Southern California. But even as peace was proclaimed and the surrender complete, other prisoners still hadn't tasted freedom yet. Such was the case for a man who would become good friends with Sanchez in his final years. Jack Schwartz had been captured on Guam on the second day of the war. Had the fighting lasted into the fall or winter of 1945, he likely wouldn't have survived at the Roku Roshi prison camp.
The war was over August the 14th. But we were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks, and it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us. And 2 hours later, the parachutes were dropping out of the cab full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
Kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of it anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads. And we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy. And they put the Navy people on board the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags. And they gave us uniforms. They wore cappy uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the plane to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. All you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us. Because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody.
So VJ Day in mid-August didn't mean everyone was out of the woods, and not even that formal surrender on September 2nd wrapped things up for prisoners like Jack Schwartz, who hadn't been liberated yet. But the significance of what took place on the USS Missouri 75 years ago was underscored for millions of Americans listening to some of these very radio stations you're listening to right now by one of Missouri's native sons, our 33rd president, Harry Truman.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest. It was a long road to Tokyo and a bloody one. We shall not forget Pearl Harbor. The Japanese militarists will not forget the USS Missouri. The evil done by the Japanese warlords can never be repaired or forgotten. But their power to destroy and kill has been taken from them. Their armies, and what is left of their navy, are now impotent. To all of us, there comes first a sense of gratitude to Almighty God, who sustained us and our allies in the dark days of grave danger, who made us to grow from weakness into the strongest fighting force in history, and who has now seen us overcome the forces of tyranny that sought to destroy his civilization. God grant that in our pride of this hour, we may not forget the hard tasks that are still before us, that we may approach these with the same courage, zeal, and patience with which we faced the trials and problems of the past 4 years. Our first thoughts, of course, thoughts of gratefulness and deep obligation, go out to those of our loved ones who have been killed or maimed in this terrible war. On land and sea and in the air, American men and women have given their lives so that this day of ultimate victory might come and assure the survival of a civilized world. No victory can make good their loss. We think of those whom death in this war has hurt, taking from them fathers, husbands, sons, brothers and sisters whom they love. No victory can bring back the faces they long to see. Only the knowledge that the victory, which these sacrifices have made possible, will be wisely used, can give them any comfort. It is our responsibility, ours, the living, to see to it that this victory shall be a monument worthy of the dead who died to win it. All millions of men and women in our armed forces and merchant marines, all over the world, who, after years of sacrifice and hardship and peril, have been spared by Providence from harm. We think of all the men and women and children who, during these years, have carried on at home in lonesomeness and anxiety and fear. Our thoughts go out to the millions of American workers and businessmen, to our farmers and miners, to all those who have built up this country's fighting strength and who have shipped to our allies the means to resist and overcome the enemy. Our thoughts go out to our civil servants and to the thousands of Americans who, at personal sacrifice, have come to serve in our government during these trying years. To the members of the Selective Service Boards and Ration Boards, to the Civilian Defense and Red Cross workers, to the men and women in the USO and in the entertainment world, to all those who have helped in this cooperative struggle to preserve liberty and decency in the world. We think of our departed gallant leader, Franklin D. Roosevelt, defender of democracy, architect of world peace and cooperation. And our thoughts go out to our gallant allies in this war, to those who resisted the invaders, to those who were not strong enough to hold out, but who, nevertheless, kept the fires of resistance alive within the souls of their people, to those who stood up against great odds and held the line until the United Nations together were able to supply the arms and the men with which to overcome the forces of evil. This is a victory of more than arms alone. This is a victory of liberty over tyranny. From our war plants rolled the tanks and planes which blasted their way to the heart of our enemy. From our shipyards sprang the ships which bridged all the oceans of the world for our weapons and supplies. From our farms came the food and fiber for our armies and navies and for our allies in all the corners of the earth. From our mines and factories came the raw materials and the finished products, which gave us the equipment to overcome our enemies. But back of it all were the will and spirit and determination of a free people who know what freedom is and who know that it is worth whatever price they had to pay to preserve it. It was the spirit of liberty which gave us our armed strength and which made our men invincible in battle. We now know that that spirit of liberty, the freedom of the individual, and the personal dignity of man are the strongest and toughest and most enduring forces in all the world. And so on VJ Day, we take renewed faith and pride in our own way of life. We have had our day of rejoicing over this victory. We have had our day of prayer and devotion. Now let us set aside VJ Day as one of renewed consecration to the principles which have made us the strongest nation on earth and which, in this war, we have striven so mightily to preserve. Those principles provide the faith, the hope, and the opportunity which help men to improve themselves and their lot. Liberty does not make all men perfect, nor all society secure, but it has provided more solid progress and happiness and decency for more people than any other philosophy of government in history. And this day has shown again that it provides the greatest strength and the greatest power which man has ever reached. We know that under it we can meet the hard problems of peace which have come upon us. A free people with free allies who can develop an atomic bomb can use the same skill and energy and determination to overcome all the difficulties ahead. Victory always has its burdens and its responsibilities as well as its rejoicing. But we face the future and all its dangers with great confidence and great hope. America can build for itself a future of employment and security. Together with the United Nations, it can build a world of peace founded on justice, fair dealing, and tolerance. As President of the United States, I proclaim Sunday, September the 2nd, 1945, to be VJ Day, the day of the formal surrender of Japan. It is not yet the day for the formal proclamation of the end of the war, nor of the cessation of hostility, but it is a day which we Americans shall always remember as a day of retribution, as we remember that other day, the day of infamy. From this day we move forward. We move toward a new era of security at home. With the other United Nations, we move toward a new and better world of cooperation, of peace, and international goodwill. God's help has brought us to this day of victory. With His help, we will attain that peace and prosperity for ourselves and all the world in the years ahead.
President Harry Truman addressing the nation 75 years ago as World War II officially came to an end. Even in the wake of that incredible victory and the crucial unity of purpose in this country that produced it, there were severe inequities, wrongs that needed to be righted, and historians today agree that Truman deserves credit for addressing them. In July 1946, in what Japanese Americans refer to now as the Day of Affirmation, the Nisei veterans of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team marched down Constitution Avenue to the ellipse of the White House, and President Truman decorated their colors with the Presidential Unit Citation. It was an acknowledgement by Truman not only of the unsurpassed courage of the 442, Americans of Japanese ancestry fighting while many of their families remained behind barbed wire back home, but also of their loyalty, of their value, of the reality that they were just as American as anyone else. 2 years after that, Truman would issue Executive Order 9981, abolishing discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin in the U.S. Armed Forces. World War II had provided a canvas on which those Japanese Americans and also over a million African American servicemen and women, even in a segregated military, had demonstrated their ability, their bravery, their loyalty, and in so doing, exposed the foolishness of racial prejudice. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more of what you would have heard on the radio 75 years ago this week, from General Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Chester Nimitz aboard the USS Missouri. And we'll hear more about what will happen on that historic battleship on the 75th anniversary of that formal surrender. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.